The more progressive people, younger people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other people can somehow change the party. I don't know if that'll happen or not. We can hope. But, you know, and so for some reason, a lot of Republicans are kind of anti-war. Well, some of them, you know, like Pat Buchanan, who I disagree with in almost everything I could think of, but on war and peace issues, he's not bad. Read some of his articles, you know, and maybe they called isolationists, but you know, you find this weird situation where liberals are in favor of wars, and some of the Republicans are more in favor of peace, unless they have their own, you know, Trump's enemy is Iran and China. Where the Democrats seem to want to go after Russia more. So they have different enemies, you know. It's a weird situation.
You know, it was interesting. Just the other day, I was speaking of Pepe Escobar, and he posted on his Facebook page, tweet from Trump. And the tweet from Trump is this, that came out the other day. It says, the United States has spent $8 trillion fighting and policing in the Middle East. Thousands of our great soldiers have died and been badly wounded. Millions of people have died on the other side. Going into the Middle East is the worst decision ever made in the history of our country. We went to war under a false and now disproven premise, weapons of mass destruction. There were none. Now we're slowly and carefully bringing our great soldiers and military home. Our focus is on the big picture. The USA is greater than ever before. Now that is Donald Trump, which I and Pepe Escobar says this has got to be one of the most explosive outbursts ever by a POTUS, no less. When Trump tweets truth, yes, it does happen. It's always astonishing.
Well, that's true. You know, if you didn't know who, if you didn't have a signature below that tweet, you'd think that was some rational person, you know?
No, I have no idea what's the motive behind that guy for saying those things. You know, I don't know. It's just really an incredible puzzle. But the idea of war and peace, thinking, well, we finally get rid of Bush, then we'll have peace. But it wasn't like that at all. Obama just bombed people just as much as anybody.
Well, he did. I had a guy on my show not too long ago, Jeremy Kuzmarov, wrote a book about Obama's Endless Wars. And he goes into them. That's a very interesting book. I recommend it. But I don't know.
I can have 10 shows with you, Pear. We've got a lot to talk about, and I really appreciate that you are here at KBOO and have been here for a long time, a warrior for peace. His book, if you haven't picked it up, his novel is called Jack Maloney's Century, and it traces 80 years into the future. And possibilities for how human beings. Actually, it's a very optimistic novel, I think. There's a lot of love in there. You even have some sex scenes. And so it is Pear Fogering, Jack Maloney. A last word, Pear, before we go.
Kind of got a nice cover too. Hey, I did the cover myself with colored pencil, but it shows the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Mall, which is flooded. And here's a guy sitting in this little rowboat fishing on the mall in front of the U.S. Capitol. So kind of a pretty picture in a way, you know.
That's right. Pear Fogering has been my guest on the Beloved Community. And until next time, I'm John Shuck. Be well.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
KBOO is hiring a full-time web coordinator. The web coordinator maintains the front end of KBOO's website, promotes episodes, does copy editing, and helps train staff and volunteers on various website features. For the full job description and instructions for applying, please go to our website at kboo.fm/webhire23. Applications are due at midnight on Thursday, March 9th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials like Black History and Future series. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $17,000 goal by March 25th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we continue our reporting from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, where the Flashpoints team has been documenting the 50th anniversary of the founding of the American Indian Movement and taking down and recording sacred oral histories. Today on the show, we hear the moving memories of Indigenous warrior leader Phyllis Young, an early AIM leader and a powerful figure on the international AIM leadership movement. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. I almost sounded like I yelled at you. Stay tuned. I do want you to stay tuned. I want to share this announcement with you. I was trying very hard to get a report on what's happening with that railroad dioxin crash, if you will, that crash in which finally the government is starting, just beginning to admit the dangers and the expansive nature of the dangers that are facing the people along that railroad line that were impacted. We were hoping to get on a wonderful scientist, Eric Capolino, who is a reporter and reports on science and knows a lot about dioxin, and that is what's going on here. I don't think we're going to be able to get it on today, but we are going to watch that very closely, and we're going to bring you an extended report with Eric tomorrow if we can't squeeze it in today. Anyway, I want to tell you that we're on that train crash, that toxic train crash, and the amount of those that occur and are never reported is insane. Anyway, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Did I tell you we report every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network? Today, well, most of our team is on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. We've been documenting the 50th anniversary of the founding of the American Indian Movement, the modern American Indian Movement, changed the nature of activism in the 70s and brought a new awareness to the ongoing, and it is an ongoing, genocide against Indian peoples based on the fact that the United States government continues to push them off their land, to remove them from their land because they need to extract what's underneath. So we're very close to the indigenous communities, and we have the team there. and wanted to begin today. We want to share with you a very special extended speech. The women warriors were speaking out in the last couple of days. And among those speaking was a very significant player and founder in the early American Indian movement, Phyllis Young. She knows a great deal about international law, about all the intricacies of the birth of the American Indian movement. And so we wanted to share her sharing in terms of her experiences in this, the celebration of the American Indian movement. Listen to this.
We'll have another person who we're honoring today who's close to our family, especially my brother Russell, and that's Phyllis Young. How are you?
I use a cane, but I didn't. I'm tough today. 50 years survival. Chante washte nape chuzape. Mini tahiyawi himachape. Na mini yuha najui himachape. I'm a woman who stands by the water, woman who loves the water. It's my birthday, and there's nothing like celebrating your 74th birthday going to Wounded Knee. I'm a master production of colonization. I learned their language fluently. I learned all of the base line of languages, endured their boarding school. I'm a boarding school survivor. I'm doing a documentary, which is probably the most horrific story in the state of South Dakota for Indian boarding schools. But I met Russell Means on relocation. I was recruited, and we joked about it over the years because I was recruited by the United States government. I worked for Foreign Service at the State Department, a product of the United States. I come from a family of military heroes. I have a grandfather in 1918 that was a code talker, and that was a classified document till 2010. So 47 code talkers from Standing Rock, 17 from First World War, and 17 code talkers from the Second World War were all classified. So there never was the pomp and circumstance of Navajo Nation. So oftentimes they would say, oh, I didn't know you're Navajo when you talked about grandfathers. But I am a product of colonization. And Russ always joked about me being the government witness that he stole from the government. Well, everybody talked about the government witness for the government, but they never talked about the government witness who was me that they stole from the United States. So I worked for Foreign Service in Washington, D.C. for the United States Department of State. And I learned diplomacy, protocol, professionalism, and I took the best of what America had to offer. I had some of the best teachers, those who worked for good people, and measured Americans by their own standards. And the ones that we thought were a lot of good Americans were not, and vice versa. But I met at a time in my life three prophets, and they were in service training, as we would say today, for the United States government. So when I met Russell Means, he was a kind of an uptown guy. He had a suit on, dapper dresser, eloquent speaker, and he taught the methodologies of the United States government, along with Dennis Hastings, who was Omaha and a real prophet as well. And then there was a Mohawk. So their talk was about Mother Earth. Very early on, you're sitting there, there were 50 of us who were recruited by the United States, all women. And so it was a different kind of training, because here I am, I'm from the chocolate factory, and I learned to love myself as a Tootsie Roll, short and sweet. But I learned to be tough over the years. I used to think I'm a big chicken. I'm scared of everything, my shadow. And I like the American way. Ted Means always gave me the hardest time because I wore go-go boots, high heels, dresses, and mini skirts. And he never let me forget that time in my life. When I met her, she had on a white fur and go-go boots. But I transitioned for 50 years. And I'm very privileged to have endured, transitioned, and become the real me. And it was the American Indian Movement who nurtured me, who I value for the lessons that I learned. Before Russell Means passed away, I told him, I'm not afraid. I will never be afraid of anything the rest of my life. And that's why we had Ocheti Shakoi reborn at Standing Rock. I give him credit. I owe him. Because I want to do quickly a chronology. Meeting him in that in-service training, and he told us, all of us women from the reservations, that we were the most beautiful people in the world. That as matriarchs, we had the potential to be true to ourselves. And 50 years or at his funeral, this our other sister from Navajo Nation, we told the same story. And I said, he told me I was the most beautiful woman in the world. When she got up at his funeral, she said, he told me I was the most beautiful woman in the world. So Dine Nation and Lakota Nation, we are the most beautiful people in the world. We agreed. So with that, he told us what we had the potential to be. Long story short, I left the United States government, Foreign Service Division. I worked for ambassadors and career ministers. I did their itineraries and sent them all over different places of the world, taught patriotism, and I learned patriotism, but I redirected it to my own heart, my own spirit, my own drive and tenacity for Lakota Nation. So great lessons in my life. So from there, I went to Cleveland, Ohio, and I had graduated from I am a paralegal for 2 years of college in Cleveland, Ohio. And I went back there, and Russell Means was working for the CEO, the Poor People's Campaign in Cleveland, Ohio, and he was the Indian representative. And so we got together, and we helped to build and form, establish the American Indian Center in Cleveland, Ohio, for those of us indigenous people who went there on relocation. And I learned that we were going home. That was my first lesson. Changed from being a career person in the United States' ambassadorship program to being an ambassador going home to my own people. So in 1970, there was a national call from Frank Fulcrow at Pine Ridge, and he said, we're coming to talk about the religious freedom and separating the sacred Sundance from the circus. And that was at Pine Ridge. You had the carnival, the rodeo, the powwow, all of the goings on, the fairs, and the Sundance. But the Sundance was a tourist attraction, and it was a fake social dance. And I told Russ I would never tell this until he was long gone. But he was one of the dancers that was paid for that social dance that was the Sundance. But we came back in 1970, Madonna and Mabel Ann and another sister from Panama. They hitchhiked from Cleveland, Ohio. I can see their backs with their blue jeans and boots and heading out with their thumbs out, and they hitchhiked home. They made it before I did. I drove because I had the children. I had Don and Chuske and my own children. So we made it here. Fool's Cove gave us a direction that we would now defy the U.S. policy and start practicing the Indian Religious Act that was the most sacred act, and that was the Sundance. So we were introduced to the late medicine man, Mestet. Mestet, he was a professor at Oglala Lakota College. He was 15 years old, and we were instructed to follow the ways of him. So from that time on, we defied the policy prohibiting the sacred Sundance at in Indian country. So the Sundance was held at Crow Dog's Paradise with Leonard Crow Dog from 1970 to 1978, when it was made a legal practice with the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. But those dancers were Russell Means, Ted Means, Mitchell Zephyr, and Ed McGaugh. Those were Oglalas who were part of that Sundance. And so honor, praise, and to them for initiating the illegal practice into the right of our own people. So we marched in 1970, the Trail of Broken Treaties. Russ and I worked for Russell Means now in Cleveland, Ohio, at the American Indian Center. And we mobilized as part of the last leg to Washington, D.C. for the Trail of Broken Treaties. And that was 20 points that were generated by the American Indian Policy Commission. And I want to give grateful condolences, grateful for his life, the greatest senator, James Aberesk, who was a drafter and founder and initiator of the American Indian Policy Review Commission's 20 points for our freedom of religion, for untying those ropes of colonization, prohibiting our way of life and the most sacred ceremony that we had. So I thank the Aberesk family, my condolences, my love to you at this time, because he passed away on Friday. And so we give thanks for his life and celebrate him for the freedom that we practice today. A great act. So we marched, and because of that march, the government paid us money to go home, gas money. So Russell Means and I each got some money, and he went back to Cleveland. I went back to Cleveland. We were both fired by the board of directors. So I got a call from the chairman of Standing Rock in December of 72, and offered me a job. So I immediately went back to Standing Rock after the Trail of Broken Treaties. And Russ went home with an entourage of Oglalas that took Oglala country by storm because of the murders and deaths of Bad Heart Bull. Raymond Yellow Thunder, who were murdered on the outskirts of Oglala Nation. And so the Oglalas were adamant that the murders would not be dealt, would not be accepted. So Custer Courthouse was burnt down by Oglalas on the rampage and wanted retaliation. So we have a history of insurrection but it's not the typical American fighting American like what happened at the Capitol on January 6th of last year. It was to preserve the life, blood of our own people and Oglala Nation. So those ensuing years, 72 and 73, culminated in hearing processes for civil rights throughout the communities in Oglala Nation. And when it came to Wounded Knee, it was too much to bear the crimes against the people, the men, the women, and the use of guns against our own people. So in 1973, I was not an active part in Wounded Knee. I was never inside. My father had passed away like the day before. So I could not come at the call. So I buried my father, and I was a week later. I went to the Rapid City office and opened a business office. And there were great people from all over the country that sent telegrams and money and support. Ossie Davis, an actor, his wife, and the Brown Berets from Denver, and people that came in force. And so my job there was to I took Ted Means, my brother, I took Jim Claremont, Edgar Bear Runner, and I was a runner with my car into Interior, over to Rosebud, back into Manderson, taking the men there, dropping them off, and going back out. And then when the airlifts came with supplies, I packed the backpacks and put them on the runners, and they walked all of the medical supplies and some food, whatever they needed on their backs, and they walked in there. So we had airlifts, we had airplanes, we had people from supported us all over the world, and then there was a blackout. So I worked in that business office until the FBI shut down the office in Rapid City. And then after 71 days after the negotiations, and great respect to Ramon Roubidoux, who probably could have been a top-notch U.S. Attorney in this country, but who gave that up so he could be a treaty representative attorney. Never forget him. And he always had his heart with the American Indian Movement. And all of the lawyers who participated and helped us across this land. So there was a lot of documentation going on. And the chiefs, the traditional chiefs, wanted to come to Standing Rock. And they called. So they immediately, the chairman called me and asked me to talk to the Oglalas who wanted to come. Turned out it was Russell Means, who was the messenger coming from Oglala Nation, asking for Standing Rock to host the International Indian Treaty Council and seek human rights and a seat at the United Nations. So it was hard at first because, like I said, the steps of colonization, every council member said, no, we won't do it. But when Fools Crow walked in full regalia with his whole Oglala entourage and spoke only Lakota to our tribal council at Standing Rock, there were moments of stone silence, and the tribal council unanimously voted to host that first International Treaty Council on June 20th, 1974. So there were over 5,000 people who came from Indian country and indigenous communities, and that had a simple declaration. The declaration was, number one objective was to support the continuing independence of Oglala Nation. The second objective was to create an embassy in Lakota country to deal with the United States, nation to nation. So very simple, that was drafted, passed, and taken. So in that time period from 74 to 75, Russell Means came to Standing Rock, and I was in Cleveland, Ohio at a meeting, and Russell was shot at Standing Rock. And so people mobilized, someone bought a house in Bismarck, there was a legal office set up, and people came from all over once again to defend him. He was charged with assault on a federal officer, later acquitted. And during that time, I flew from Cleveland, and the FBI, he had two bodyguards, and I went there and I asked him, okay, your life is on the edge, so what is the direction that we are going in our work? And he said, you need to open that treaty office. So I don't know how I did it, but I went to New York City, and there was work ongoing in a church building at United Nations right across. We had some great people who were supporters. The actors, the Screen Actors Guild, many of those actors who were blacklisted during the McCarthy era and considered communists. We had a number of people from the cinema, movie actors, who supported the effort. So from 75 to 77, we worked on the credentials seeking NGO status in the United Nations to participate in the UN. So I spent those years, 3 years, working for the International Indian Treaty Council, being mugged on the subway and refusing to go in there anymore, and kind of had to be taken around in taxi cab or bus or escort. So wasn't easy. And it was my first experience with culture shock at that level. So 77, we went to, we had the credentials received. After 3 years, we were always told, well, Tanzania, it took them 17 years. So sister, you're going to be here for 20 years before you get your credentials. We got them in 3 years. So I never believe anyone when you have your own heart and spirit in your drive. We can do it. We can get there. So by 1977, we were a host to the first conference on land and Indian people's rights in Geneva, Switzerland. And so we mobilized Leonard Krodog, who was our spiritual leader for the American Indian Movement, refused to go. Henry Krodog refused to go. The sacred medicine men all refused to go to Geneva. We cannot leave this land and cross those waters. So I learned some great lessons from that and from them. But I was in Geneva for about 7 weeks, homesick as hell. But culture shock at another level, but then kind of could sense like the boarding school aura. And it was kind of scary. But when everybody was arriving, here I was, tear down my face. And they were like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, I want to go home. Everybody was just getting there. So there was a move internationally for people to go all over the world. Indian people were invited everywhere. And I was invited to Russia, to Helsinki, to Spain, to South America, everywhere. And I went to Holland because I wanted to see the World Court. And I spent a lot of time, and I eventually took five of my children to the World Court. And my daughter, Washtewi Young, sat in the Chief Justice's seat with that massive gavel and said, the world will now come to order. And I always remind her of that when she was at the camp at Ochechi Shakowi at Standing Rock, because I said, it's time to go now. And she slapped her teepee flaps closed, and she said, you raised me. So I said, excuse me, and I had to go the other way. But she maintains her spirit. And so we did the international work I did personally for 20 years until there was suicide at Standing Rock. And then I quit for 10 years. And but we still move forward. Russell Means has continued all of his work. He, one important potential move that will be happening is energy development and recognition of cold fusion, which he endorsed in 2010 with scientists. And it is now coming to the top of the agenda for free energy and for safe energy. And they're proposing to have the first development at Porcupine with the permission of the family and those who will participate in it, creating a glass, four directions glass that will create energy for like a six bedroom house or the museum that they planned on. That is open for the development to happen here with the right path that we can take. But I wanted to honor my brother. He was my brother. I was privileged to know Auntie Vera and Theo, Auntie Faith, Grandma Faith. Those were my mentors. Big humpas to follow, but to have the free spirit and to have prophets, I can no longer say anything in any sense except the spiritual sense, that I was really privileged to have the life I did, to follow the humpas of Lakota Nation. I thank Oglala Nation for letting me work and serve for in your capacity for 40 years and teaching me the lessons on how to establish a greater sense by putting together Ocheti Shakoi and lighting those fires. So we continue. So on Tuesday, we will be having Ocheti Shakoi. The 26 river tribes will be meeting to offset the 22 states who are claiming the water against Biden. And we will be going into reparations for each of the 17 provisions of 1868. We're amending the Constitution for Standing Rock to include the 1851 treaty. And we have filed 10 lawsuits. We are filing once again against DAPL. We're not stopping. So I just wanna thank all of you for being here. I thank the feather necklace, Teoshpa, for being part of my family, for teaching me, for bringing me back into Hochoka, bringing me back to who I really am and having a sense of identity, and being 74 years old and being here to celebrate 50 years of liberation and freedom. So lila wopila tanka.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein. We're listening to extraordinary voices. That was a moving talk by Phyllis Young, one of the early founders of the American Indian Movement. The Flashpoints team has gone to the reservation, has gone to South Dakota to document the 50th anniversary of the founding of the American Indian Movement. We've been honored to be able to cover the movement, to work with the movement on various projects, to document different things that the movement has been doing over the years. It's an incredible privilege to have this kind of connection. I want to let you know you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and some of you will continue to hear some more voices from Coming Out West, and others will hear me, and I don't know who else, I'm not sure, but we'll take a short break. We'll be back. We are so glad that you could talk to us. We're honored that you would talk to us today in this 50th anniversary celebration of the founding, of the birth of the American Indian Movement. And let's just jump right in. Well, what happened some 50 years ago that led to this movement? Certainly, in part, it was the ongoing endless genocide of the United States government against the indigenous communities of North America. Sort of set the scene. What was going on 50 years ago, and why did there have to be an uprising?
Well, first of all, the conditions on the reservation were astoundingly bad in terms of the any social measurement that we used. And we had the highest rate of tuberculosis at the time. We had high crime. We had high unemployment. We only had we had 80% unemployment. We had low education rate. The average person in high school, or the average Indian, only went to eighth grade in education. And so all these things were very low. This was in, as you recall, 1973. And of course, we went to Wounded Knee. We chose that spot. It was chosen by our chiefs and elders because the mass grave that happened, massacre in 1890, happened there at Wounded Knee. So every day we drive by that place and see our ancestors who are laying there buried in a mass grave, the largest killing at the time throughout the Americas. And of course, they've surpassed that several times now in Guatemala and other regions where our relatives are trying to survive. But the reason why we went to Wounded Knee is the chiefs told us we won't be alone because our ancestors are buried there. And so they're going to help us. And it's going to be tough, but you guys have to be brave. That's what they told us. And then we went to Wounded Knee. The BIA had barricaded the federal building and BIA building in Pine Ridge, which is the capital community of our reservation. And so we went right through Pine Ridge and went on to Wounded Knee. So
Pine Ridge to Wounded Knee. Bill, can I ask you, can you move a little bit away from the speaker, because we're getting a little overflow from the, I guess,
right,
the speaker system that's coming in there.
Getting a little feedback?
Yeah, it's just that if you could
just right here.
That's a little better. That's a little better. Thank you. So, Bill, you at the time were coming out of the military. You were actually in Vietnam. You were sort of supposedly fighting for the rights of majority Americans. Of course, the Vietnam War was ugly, but really, you didn't have those rights that you were asked to die for.
Say again, we're just now starting the program, so I kind of got interrupted there by a mistake.
Not a problem. When you came 50 years ago, you were coming back from the U.S. military. You were like fighting in a war, supposedly, for other people's freedom when the indigenous communities of North America were continually being ethnically cleansed. That is that part of the what led to the uprising?
Yes, of course, but I think it was very confusing and kind of a contradiction to myself and other veterans, because all of a sudden now we were the oppressor in Vietnam. and allegedly fighting for our country and honoring the draft of the United States at the time. So it was very tough to deal with those type of contradictions. But what I like to say is that we were busy in a survival mode. We were surviving, trying to stay alive. And so we were able to survive by concentrating our life and our world in getting back home. So, yes, we came back. We found out that while we were fighting for this country, they were still stealing our land back home for minerals and other extractive industries operating in the Black Hills of South Dakota, where we as a people were born. That's our creation story, is in the Black Hills. So that's our Jerusalem. So these are the things that we thought about. And then, of course, we came back to the corruption of tribal government, which is a puppet government of the United States colonialism. And we were barely able to, at that time, to address the situation there through the American Indian Movement. There was also a movement locally called the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Department, Oglala Sioux Civil OSCRO, Civil Rights Organization. And so they were fighting for the rights of the people, individual rights on the reservation, strictly on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which at the time had the most issues with the social standing of conditions we lived under. And so we were trying to address those conditions, as well as the racism in and around the reservation, what they call border towns. And so in those border towns, we had Indians chained to the side of the jail, in various jails around the reservation. We had a young man killed by white ranchers in Gordon, Nebraska, 1972. His name was Raymond Yellow Thunder. So these issues brought us to Pine Ridge, and we were invited there by the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization. And so we just didn't come there out of a whim. We were invited, plus many of us in AIM at the time, which started 1968. So they had been alive working on these social issues for many years, at least about 5 years before Wounded Knee. So these are, we were involved in, you know, many things, like to take over the Bureau of Indian Affairs in November of 72. Which was just prior to Wounded Knee, which happened in, of course, February of 73. So less than 6 months later, we were in Wounded Knee when we came back from the BIA. So we always attacked the various institutions that control our life. Greatest enemies of Indian people, we determined as being the United States government, the churches, and education, for all the ways that they tried to edit us out of existence, like we didn't even know who we were. Even in our own schools on the reservation, they couldn't teach the language. We were punished if you spoke the language. Or we couldn't hear our song, we didn't have our ceremonies available. So these are things that we were fighting against and for our own civil rights on and off the reservation. So I wanted to say that much as far as why we went into Wounded Knee was because of those conditions. And number one, because of our treaties. We had valid international treaties that were signed by the United States government, passed through the Senate, and became treaty law. But yet, when it came to the time of stealing our land, our resources in the Black Hills, the gold mining, coal mining, stealing our water, all those things took place prior to Wounded Knee. And even now today, we're having a presentation on the present grab for natural resources. Again, they're coming back to take more gold. What they're doing, not mining through the hill, they're strip mining the Black Hills. And they take thousands and thousands of, land, just to say that they need that money for defense, or they need the money for United States Treasury, or they need it for national security. And so they use these laws against us to go around the treaty law. But yet still, we still know that the treaties are alive and well, because in Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, it says treaty law shall be the supreme law of the land. So we understand our own history. We know about that. And so we went to Wounded Knee on advice of our chiefs and headsmen, our elders, like I said, because they knew we wouldn't be alone. We'd be there with our ancestors of the massacre of 1890. And so this was the process that we used to choose Wounded Knee specifically by our elders, chiefs, and headsmen. And so this is what brought us there. And then afterwards, we were there 71 days in a firefight with United States forces, U.S. government, FBI, U.S. Marshal, Border Patrol, BIA police, and several other jurisdictions came to Wounded Knee. Over 500 to 1,000 men came there. And so during that time of 71 days, we had 10,000 Indian people that came from various parts of the country to support us, because we made Wounded Knee a household name, and people understood that we were under attack by United States government. And this small band of Indian people on the reservation, they came to us and asked for help through the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization. So we responded. And we thank you for putting this on so we can relive this history, our 50th anniversary. And so I'm very, very honored to be on to KPFA for publicizing this event, but also for reminding America that we're still here and we have the right to be here. We're the original people of this land. We didn't come from Asia. We call that the Bering Straits, the BS theory. Because it's all a bunch of the BS theory. Excuse my language, but I had to get that in there to talk all about right. The American
Bill.
History.
Bill, yes. Dennis Berenstein here. I want to let people know that we're speaking with Bill Means. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the founding of the American Indian Movement. So the Flashpoints team has, and other KPFA folks have, if you will, invaded the region in the Dakotas. We're speaking with William Means. He is the founder, co-founder of the American Indian Movement. And Bill, I guess I could put it this way. The open wound of the movement and the struggle is the fact that Leonard Peltier, one of the most significant, if not the most significant, political prisoner in the world, still rots in a U.S. jail, and politicians are still shuddering and terrified to release, to do the release, which would is such a dark mark on U.S. Current policy that it's troubling. And the Biden administration, just like the Trumpies, refused to free Leonard Peltier. Why is that important now, Bill?
Well, because he represents the treatment of Indian people by the U.S. government. He represents a symbol of the history of America's relations with our Indian people. And so he stands as one of those, one of us, who stood at Wounded Knee and after Wounded Knee to protect the elders again in various communities in which we're being attacked by these paramilitaries who were formed up by the FBI. A lot of this testimony came out in the Wounded Knee trials. So I'm not just making this up. This is a matter of historical and legal records. So I just want to say that, of course, we continue that resistance to deny us our culture, our way of life, and our land, and the Black Hills especially, because they're still trying to pay us money for the Black Hills when they're not for sale. That's where we were born as a people. That's our Jerusalem. That's our Vatican. So these are the important things that we have a right to be who we are. We have the right to speak our language. So I keep bringing these issues up because we're still fighting those battles. Matter of fact, we're going to have a report here in some of our organizing for this event about the water, theft of water in the mining industry. They're polluting our beautiful Black Hills watershed by digging in the ground and using these severe chemicals like hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, to separate the ore from the mineral. And they take a half a mountain to get a half an ounce of gold. So, you know, that's the type of mining they're doing these days. It's over and above strip mining. At least strip mining, there were particular certain areas, but the mining they're doing now is just overall genocide, overall a type of degradation of Mother Earth. Unbelievable degradation. And a lot of it is in our sacred sites around this country. So we really appreciate this chat to lend our voice to KPFA, because our radio station, Kili, K-I-L-I, on Pine Ridge Reservation, we call the voice of the Lakota Nation, started because of station like KPFA. And we came up in 1983. So it took us 10 years to get started after Wounded Knee, but we took the example of KPFA speaking the truth to the people, speaking the truth to America, that there's some place you can find the truth about American Indians, and it's on our radio station, which is K-I-L-I, Kili, which is even a Lakota word in our language that means good, man, strong, powerful. That's what Kili means, beautiful. And so that's the reason why we chose that name and those call signs, because it has a significant meaning amongst our people. And we thank KPFA again for the inspiration, for the continued solidarity through the years, for helping us. Every chance they got, they come there and advise us on various technicalities of the radio industry. And so we still owe a big favor to the people of KPFA. Now they're here sitting right with us, which is... you know, amazing that they're here amongst our people, because they're not trying to report from off the scene or from another city or another area. They're right here sitting with us, eating food with us, and we really appreciate the presence of KPFA, because they're doing a yeoman's job. They're doing what nobody else can do in the Bay Area or other places, because they have various restrictions of you know, policies, etc. So we really want to appreciate again and thank KPFA.
Well, thank you, Bill. I'm going to invoke my Indian name given to me by you. It's Burnstick here. It's the, it's the Sioux and the Jew. And we are so honored to have this kind of connection with you, Bill, and with the American Indian Movement and the struggles that go on now. I'm thinking the United States has, in the last year or so, sent $100 billion in military aid to Ukraine. What do you think the indigenous communities, they don't seem to have anything for the indigenous communities in North America. You took international, UN delegations around this country to show how there are standards for indigenous communities, and then there's the rest of the folks. What do you think you all could do with $100 billion?
you know, you, We changed the attitude.
What's your thoughts on the war and all this? What are you thinking about as you see this unfold?
You know, it seems like there's always a war that the United States is involved in. And so we, including war against us. I mean, in 1890, I told you about the mass grave that still exists on our land on the reservation. Also in 1862, they hanged 38 Dakota Indians in Mankato, Minnesota, after a war, because they broke the treaty. They invaded our land, the settlers. They opened up our land for settlers. And in Minnesota, in what they call Minnesota River Valley, richest land for agriculture in the world. And so here we have a chance to say some words and remind people we're still here. We still have the same issues of land, of the environment, of water. Water for life, we say, which we say in our language, Miniwichoni. Water is life. And so we taught that phrase to the world during Standing Rock in the late, in the 2000 of, I think it was 2020, 2018, around there. So anyway, I leave you with those thoughts of, and again, okay. Leonard Peltier, he deserves to be free. He's been in jail for almost 60 years. And so here we are. Or is it, I think it's 40 years. Anyway, it's a long time. It's a lifetime.
It's a lifetime.
46 years. So I wanted to get that part straight because he deserves to be paroled or freed because of humanitarian issues, if nothing else. Just let him be in his later years. Let him go home.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up, it's The Bike Show.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the